What is the substance of story? In all other arts, the answer is self-evident. The composer has his instrument and the notes it sounds. The dancer calls her body her instrument. Sculptors chisel stone. Painters stir paint. All artists can lay hands on the raw material of their art except the writer. For at the nucleus of a story is a substance, like the energy swirling in an atom, that's never directly seen, heard, or touched, yet we know it and feel it. The stuff of story is alive, but intangible. Intangible, I hear you thinking. But I have my words, dialogue, description. I can put hands on my pages. The writer's raw material is language. But in fact, language is not the stuff of story. To understand story's substance and how it performs, you need to view your work from the inside out, from the center of your character, looking out at the world through the character's eyes, experiencing the story as if you were the living character yourself. In order to slip into this subjective point of view, you need to look closely at the creature you intend to inhabit, a character, or, more specifically, a protagonist. The number and variety of protagonists is unlimited. Generally, the protagonist is a single character. But from Thelma and Louise to the Seven Samurai to the Dirty Dozen, two or more characters may form a plural protagonist. If so, two conditions must be met. First, for all individuals in the group to fill the role of protagonist, all must share the same desire. Second, in the struggle to achieve this desire, they must suffer and benefit mutually. A story may, on the other hand, be multi-protagonist. Here, unlike the plural protagonist, characters pursue separate and individual desires, suffering and benefiting independently. Pulp Fiction, Hannah and Her Sisters, Diner. The protagonist need not be human. It may be an animal, Babe, or a cartoon, Bugs Bunny, or even an inanimate object, such as the hero of the children's story, The Little Train That Could. Anything that can be given a free will, the capacity to desire, to take action and suffer the consequences, can be a protagonist. It's even possible, in rare cases, to switch protagonists halfway through a story. Psycho does this, making the shower murder both an emotional and formal jolt. With the protagonist dead, the audience is momentarily confused. Who is this story about? The answer is a plural protagonist, as the victim's sister, boyfriend, and a private detective take over the story. But no matter whether the story's protagonist is single, multi, or plural, no matter how he or she is characterized, all protagonists have certain hallmark qualities, and the first is willpower. Other characters may be dogged, even rigid, but the protagonist in particular is a willful being, determined enough to sustain desire through conflict and ultimately take an action that creates meaningful and irreversible change. What's more, the true strength of the protagonist's will may hide behind a passive characterization. Consider Blanche DuBois, protagonist of A Streetcar Named Desire. At first glance, she seems weak, drifting, and will-less, only wanting, she says, to live in reality. Yet beneath her frail characterization, Blanche's deep character owns a powerful will that drives her unconscious desire. What she really wants is to escape from reality. So Blanche does everything she can to buffer herself against the ugly world that engulfs her. She acts the grande dame, puts doilies on frayed furniture, lampshades on naked light bulbs, tries to make a Prince Charming out of a dullard. When none of these succeed, she takes the final escape from reality. She goes insane. On the other hand, while Blanche only seems passive, the truly passive protagonist is a regrettably common mistake. A story cannot be told about a protagonist who doesn't want anything, who cannot make decisions, whose actions affect no change at any level. Rather, the protagonist's will impels a conscious desire. The protagonist has a need or goal, an object of desire, and is conscious of it. The protagonist knows what he or she wants. However, the most memorable, fascinating characters tend to not have only a conscious but an unconscious desire. Although these complex protagonists are unaware of their subconscious need, the audience senses it, perceiving in them an inner contradiction. The conscious and unconscious desires of a multidimensional protagonist contradict one another. What he believes he wants is the antithesis of what he actually but unwittingly wants. This is self-evident. What would be the point of giving a character a subconscious desire if it happens to be the very thing he knowingly seeks? A protagonist has the will and capacity to pursue the object of his conscious and/or unconscious desire to the end of the line, to the human limit established by setting and genre. The art of story is not about the middle ground, but about the pendulum of existence swinging to the limits, about life lived in its most intense states. We explore the middle ranges of experience, but only as a path to the end of the line. And the audience knows that limit, for no matter how intimate or epic the setting, instinctively the audience draws a circle around the characters and their world, a circumference of experience that's defined by the nature of the fictional reality. This line may reach inward to the soul, outward into the universe, or in both directions at once. We then expect the storyteller to be an artist of vision who can take his story to those distant depths and ranges, to a final action beyond which the audience cannot imagine another. The protagonist must be empathetic. He may or may not be sympathetic. Sympathetic means likable. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, for example, or Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn in their typical roles. Empathy, however, is a more profound response. Empathetic means like me. Deep within the protagonist, the audience recognizes a certain shared humanity. Character and audience are not alike in every fashion, of course. They may share only a single quality, but there's something about the character that strikes a chord. Sympathy is optional, empathy absolute. At first glance, creating empathy would not seem difficult. The protagonist is a human being. The audience is full of human beings. As the filmgoer looks up on the screen, he recognizes the character's humanity, senses that he shares it, identifies with the protagonist, and dives into the story. Indeed, in the hands of the greatest of writers, even the most unsympathetic character can be made empathetic. Macbeth, for example, viewed objectively, is a monster. He butchers a kindly old king while the man is sleeping, a king who had never done Macbeth any harm. In fact, that very day he'd given Macbeth a royal promotion. Macbeth then murders two servants of the king to blame the deed on them. He kills his best friend. Finally, he orders the assassination of the wife and infant children of his enemy. He's a ruthless killer. Yet, in Shakespeare's hands, he becomes a tragic, empathetic hero. The bard accomplished this feat by giving Macbeth a conscience. As he wanders in soliloquy, wondering, agonizing, why am I doing this? What kind of man am I? The audience listens and thinks, what kind? Guilt-ridden, just like me. I feel bad when I'm thinking about doing immoral things. I feel awful when I do them, and afterwards there's no end to the guilt. Macbeth is a human being. He has a conscience just like mine. A character's world can be imagined as a series of concentric circles surrounding a core of raw identity or awareness, circles that mark the levels of conflict in a character's life. The first circle, or level, is his own self and conflicts arising from the elements of his own nature, mind, body, emotion. When, for example, a character takes an action, his mind may not react the way he anticipates. His thoughts may not be as quick, as insightful, as witty as he expected. His body may not react as he imagined. It may not be strong enough or agile enough for a particular task. And we all know how emotions betray us. So the closest circle of antagonism in the world of a character is his own being, feelings and emotions, mind and body, all or any of which may or may not react from one moment to the next the way he expects. As often as not, we are our own worst enemy. The second circle inscribes personal relationships, unions of intimacy deeper than the social role. Social convention assigns us the outer roles we play. At the moment, for example, we're playing teacher-student. Someday, however, our paths may cross and we may decide to change our professional relationship to friendship. In the same manner, parent-child begins as social roles that may or may not become personal. Many of us go through life in parent-child relationships that never deepen beyond social definitions of authority and rebellion. Not until we set the conventional role aside do we find the true intimacy of family, friends, and lovers, who then do not react the way we expect and become the second level of personal conflict. The third circle marks the level of extra-personal conflict, all the sources of antagonism outside the personal, conflict with social institutions, cop, criminal, victim, government, citizen, church, worshiper, conflict with individuals, boss, worker, customer, waiter, doctor, patient, and conflict with the environment, both man-made and natural. The protagonist seeks an object of desire beyond his reach. Consciously and or unconsciously, he chooses to take an action motivated by the thought and or feeling that this act will cause the world to react in a way that will create a positive step toward achieving his desire. But the moment he takes this action, from his inner life, personal relationships, the extra-personal world, from any two or all three at once, comes a reaction that's more powerful than he expected, different than he expected, or both. This reaction from his world blocks his desire, thwarting him and bending him further from his desire than he was before he took this action. Rather than evoking cooperation from his world, his action provokes forces of antagonism that open up the gap between his expectation and the result, between what he thought would happen when he took his action and what in fact does happen, between his sense of probability and true necessity. Once the gap in reality splits open, the character, being willful and having capacity, senses or realizes that his world is not what he thought it to be, that he cannot get what he wants the minimal conservative way. He must gather himself and struggle through this gap to take a second action. This next action is something the character would not have wanted to do in the first case because it not only demands more willpower and forces him to dig more deeply into his human capacity, but most importantly, the second action puts him at risk. He now stands to lose in order to gain. We'd all like to have our cake and eat it too. In a state of jeopardy, on the other hand, we must put at risk something we want or have in order to gain something else that we want or protect something we have, a dilemma we would all strive to avoid. Here's a simple test to apply to your story in progress. Ask, what is the risk? What does the protagonist stand to lose if he or she does not get what he or she wants? More specifically, what's the worst thing that will happen to the protagonist if he or she does not achieve his or her desire? If the answer is not compelling, it's time for a serious rewrite. Examine your own desires. You wish to write for the cinema, the foremost media of creative expression in the world today. You wish to give us works of beauty and meaning that will help shape our vision of reality. In return, you would like to be acknowledged. It's a noble ambition and a grand achievement to fulfill. And because you're a serious artist, you're willing to risk vital aspects of your life in order to live that dream. You're willing to risk time. You're willing to risk humiliation. You're willing to risk people. The writer is willing to risk because his ambition has life-defining force. What's true for the writer is true for every character he creates. The measure of the value of a character's desire is in direct proportion to the risk he takes to achieve it. The greater the value, the greater the risk. The protagonist's first action has aroused forces of antagonism that block his desire. Now he must take a second, more difficult and risk-taking action, an action based on his expectations of the world, an action consistent with his vision of reality. His action, however, springs open a gap between expectation and result, disconfirming his notions of reality, putting him in greater conflict with his world at even greater risk. But the resilient human mind quickly remakes reality into a larger pattern that now incorporates this disconfirmation. So he ups the ante again and makes a decision to take a new action, which he feels is consistent with his new view. He reaches even more deeply into his capacities and willpower, puts himself at greater risk, and takes a third action. Perhaps this action achieves a positive result, and for the moment he takes a step toward his desire. But with his next action, the gap will crack open again. Now he must take an even more difficult action that demands even more willpower, more capacity, and more risk. Over and over again in a progression, rather than cooperation, his actions provoke forces of antagonism, opening gaps in his reality. This pattern repeats on various levels to the end of the line, to a final action beyond which the audience cannot imagine another. These cracks in moment-to-moment reality mark the difference between the dramatic and the prosaic, between action and activity. True action is physical, vocal, or mental movement that turns around gaps in expectation and creates significant change. Mere activity is behavior in which what is expected happens, generating either no change or trivial change. But the gap between expectation and result is far more than a matter of cause and effect. In the most profound sense, the break between the cause as it seemed and the effect as it turns out marks the point where the human spirit and the world meet. On one side is the world as we believe it to be. On the other is reality as it actually is. In this gap is the nexus of story, the cauldron that cooks our tellings. Here the writer finds the most powerful life-bending moments. The only way we can reach this crucial junction is by working from the inside out. Why must we do this? Why, during the creation of a scene, must we find our way to the center of each character and experience it from his or her point of view? Because if you stay outside your characters, you inevitably write emotional clichés. To create honest human reactions, you must not only get inside your character, but inside yourself.